once I knew that I had been serving a purpose greater than myself, that there are people who are vulnerable in this country, the people that are hurt first and worst by all the social ills out there, climate change and the criminal justice system and racism and systemic racism. When you know that that's why you're doing the work, the me part goes away. It doesn't become about me and what's gonna happen to me. It's just like, I have to have courage.
All right. Well, welcome back. Welcome to the High Performance Happiness Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Sharp. For those of you that are back and have been helping us get this thing going so quickly, thank you. Super grateful for the support. It has been a blast. And to be honest, a pleasant surprise to see the response. And for those of you checking us out for the first time, I often joke this is the podcast I could never find. I've been a lifelong business builder, building companies and teams for 25 years. And this is the stuff that I felt always made the biggest difference in building a company or a team, but also the stuff I struggled the most with. Like if you're looking at the video behind me, every book is all between the ears. So I've dedicated this to helping other entrepreneurs, executives, high performers, not just achieve better results, but also live better lives. And maybe another way to put it, just balance for business builders. So we get into the good stuff. We talk about the hard stuff. We try and be real. We talk about burnout and stress and scaling companies, but also the self-care that we all need to do and try and extract that from stories and relevant content like we can relate to and actually apply. So I like to say, you know, these are not stories from the mountaintop. Hopefully these are stories from the trenches with people who are doing this at a very high level right now. So there is a path. There is hope to find a balance between high performance and happiness. We're going to explore it here. So wherever you're at on that journey, cool. Join us. Let's figure it out together. And we're going to do that tonight with somebody I'm super excited to share with you. Nisha Anand. So first, I want to say welcome and thank you for being here. It's a busy time for you. So thank you.
It's a busy time, but I'm really glad to be here and talk with you.
I'm so excited. And I want to make sure for those of you that you give some, for every guest, I'd like to give some context because for you, you do a lot of media and you talk a lot about the amazing work you do. And as I mentioned, I want to talk about you. We get to talk about you. So I want to make sure the audience has a sense of what you've done. And so you're the CEO of Dream Corp, which is a national nonprofit organization, bringing people together across racial, social, and partisan lines to create a better future for all. Previously, Nisha served as chief of staff to Van Jones, who's the CNN commentator, amongst many other accolades. You have decades of experience in fundraising, grassroots activism, and media. If you read her full bio, I'll include, that's a short list, but we'll leave it at that for now. Nisha lives in Berkeley, California, Northern California. I played the Bay Area card to get her on, so I'm glad she joined. But she lives with her husband, two teenagers, a boy and a girl, I believe, and a Great Dane. We have that in common too, right?
Yeah.
Awesome. So Bay Area. Are you sport? Do you follow any sports teams at all?
Yeah, we're a baseball family. So okay. Open Days is.
So do we have to get this out of the way like right now? So is it A's for you guys probably?
Absolutely. Oakland A's, 100%, okay. All the time, season tickets, everything.
So that's going to wrap up our interview today. just kidding. I was born in San Francisco, so it just gets stamped on you. And it's,
yeah.
So, all right. Scrappy team. I like it. So thank you. Welcome. I want to first start off and just have you share a little bit about how you look at your personal and professional background, like who is Nisha and what do you do? So give us a little sense of that when people ask you, you know, what do you do? How do you describe that?
Sure. I've always been one of those softy people who just cares. And I think folks that get into the world of social justice, that's really who they are. And throughout my life, I've been trying to figure out what is my unique offering to making the world a better place. What is the thing that I can do to help change the world? And I go through a lot of pain. It's great to talk about happiness because I have been that optimist. I'm the person that sees that joy and that happiness. Yeah. And that's why I do what I do.
But I'm also motivated by the pain and the hurt and the suffering that I've seen my whole life. Really, I'm a big old softy with, and I'm an optimist, but not a naive optimist. I think I'm a determined optimist that I've seen enough people and enough individuals and institutions and organizations and systems and laws change in my lifetime to know it's possible. So I have that determination to bring more about that in the world. And in my early days, I was a little hellraiser on the streets, an activist, chaining myself to buildings, climbing structures and hanging banners. Yeah, I think I have over a dozen arrests in this country and one very notorious one internationally, and organized massive protests like WTO and the IMF World Banks. For those of you that are around our age, you will remember those protests. Mm-hmm. That was my early years. But in my later years, I wanted to really think about how to make the biggest difference possible. I had been working on small local issues, which are important. Everyone needs to work locally who wants to bring change at some point, but I knew I wanted to do it on a bigger scale. I saw some people that I had been on the streets with doing big things. I was a young mom staying at home when they were first born, and I saw Van Jones on TV, and he was someone that I'd go to protests with. And now he had served in the Obama administration. He was now on CNN. And I said, how did he move from where we were, like young hellraisers on the street, to where he is now? And I could see the difference he was making. I just put his name on a piece of paper. And I said, when I get back into working full time, I want to do something like that. And pretty shortly thereafter, a job came across my desk to do fundraising with Van Jones's nonprofit. And since then, I've been working on a national scale for social change and social justice instead of just locally.
So we could spend the whole time together on what you just said right there. It's so awesome. So first, congratulations on everything that you've accomplished. I think there's part of my goal here is just to inspire people, because it's easy to get lost in the grind and you put your blinders on as a high performer and you go. Mm-hmm. And then when you can pull back and go, whoa, people are doing this. You made a list and you opened up by struggling, figuring out what your path is and your meaning, and oh, how someone's so successful, how they struggle with that stuff too. So congratulations on what you've accomplished and how you've done it is super fascinating. And the balance you have between this self-described softy, but the strength that you have, did that always exist? Like, were you... I don't know. Those are so different strengths. Like, did you have to develop them, or were you a softy later after becoming a mom, or how did that all shake down?
I think that's a great question. I've been with my husband we started dating in, I want to say 99.
Okay.
It's a long time. It's been 22 years.
Yeah.
So he will tell you I've become a lot softer. I think the other day we were in the car or we were on a hike, actually. My daughter was talking about some TikTok stars that she wasn't happy with. And I was trying to explain, you know, how I saw that we can't really judge them. It's really hard to be famous at a young age. And I was saying all this stuff. My husband turned around. He's like, I missed when you were more judgmental. And I thought it was really funny. It's very true. I think, you know, so in some ways I've gotten a lot softer. I've been able to really understand all sides. I mean, the more I experienced in life, and I don't know this is true for other people, but the more I've experienced, the more I've been able to fully understand how different everyone's experiences are. And I think I got this in theory when I was young and I was studying, and you know, I remember in anthropology classes and things like that. And that there are a lot of ways to look at the problem. Your life experience dictates how you think and what you are and what you do. And we can care about the same thing. We can want to see the same problems solved in the world, like homelessness. Who doesn't want to end homelessness? Oh, but we might have completely different ways of getting about that. Right. And a lot of that's dictated by so much of our life experience. And once I'm able to understand that, we want the same goal, we might go about it differently. And that might make us hate each other and be enemies or whatever happens in this world. But if I can understand you come at it for a reason, from something you've experienced, I can work with you. And so, I've definitely become a little less judgmental. Perhaps you could say I've become a little more soft. I'd like to say I've become a little more strategic. That now,
I love that. Okay.
If I want to make the changes I always have wanted to, Yeah. I can have a lot more power by working with people who have power than just by locking myself to, you know, the stairway at the embassy, which yes, I have done, or to the Supreme Court steps, which yes, I have done. That I've actually found more strategic ways to use my ability to, and my comfort, honestly, with talking to people in all sorts of power centers in this country, to actually bring about bigger change, DC, Silicon Valley, Hollywood, Wall Street. We all have a lot of shared humanity. We have a lot of shared goals. And I think if we can harness that energy, we can do all sorts of things. And I've seen it happen. And
you have seen it happen. You've made it happen. And I want to touch on some of those. I mean, just as CEO at DreamCorp, more than 7,000 people have returned home. This might even be old stats. The first, and that was part of the First Step Act. And then in the last 18 months, 18 state bills passed, and that might even be low. So you're getting things done. It's probably a good point here. And I got so excited to dig into what you shared. How I found you was through what's now become a very famous TED talk of yours, titled The Radical Act of Choosing Common Ground. I keep calling it the Common Ground talk. So I had to make sure I got the title right.
That's fine.
So in our company, when COVID hit, I was struggling with what to do. And we started this thing called Wellness Wednesdays. Uh-huh. Half hour, if you need it, come, right? And we talk about feelings, we talk about wellness, we talk about all kinds of stuff, self-care. And then the summer hit and it got pretty intense. And we talked about a lot of things that I wasn't prepared to talk about, had to learn and get better and have some hard talks with myself. And then I think you heard there was an election.
I got wind of that.
That was a Tuesday, and a Wednesday is Wellness Wednesday. And I thought, holy shit, what do I do tomorrow?
Yeah.
What do I say? Like, I'm just going through my head. And I stumbled on your talk and I thought, oh man, Berkeley, I got to make sure I get everybody in the conversation, but I played it. And then I thought, oh my gosh. So I will link to it and everybody needs to watch this, but it speaks to where you were at. Now has over 1 million views in like 5 to 10 languages now. And you recorded it in February 2020 before the world changed. So talk a little bit about like, what was the drive? Clearly these are all values. This is authentic for you. This wasn't like a cute thing you did.
Right.
Talk about what led to that and then like what's transpired since that talk and obviously all the notoriety that came with it, but how it is more meaningful now almost, right?
I mean, it means so much more meaningful. I think it's going to be even more meaningful after the inauguration.
First
the title, I don't care what we call it. I remember very like sitting there with my assistant and my colleague and us coming up with a bunch of titles and we kind of struck out like 30 of them and this one was left. And that's, you know, unfortunately how titles
happen. That's how you got there. I love it. I love it.
I still like it because it captures something that I think is really needed right now. A lot of time when you say common ground and you say shared humanity or you say I want unity, which is the word a lot of us are saying right now, people think it's like this wishy-washy sit around the campfire, kumbaya. Right, and right. I wanted to tell the world it can be radical. This can be a radical action. That sometimes the easy thing to do is to just stay in your own bubble, create with the people who look like you, think like you, have been in your company the longest. That's the safe thing to do. It's actually much harder to say, let me reach into other sectors and see what learning I can have cross-sector. Let me talk to people of different races, different economic backgrounds, different world experiences to see what we can learn and build together. We know diversity of thought makes better products. And we don't have that same, and I'm sure this is true in business world, which I'm less familiar with, but in the nonprofit, we suffer from not reaching across the aisle, from thinking that our experience is, I think of it as often we look at people in the middle of the country to use the election right now and think that why are they voting against their self-interests? If you're a Democrat, and I assume not everyone who listens to your podcast are, hopefully you have a diverse audience.
Yeah, exactly. That's
me. I'm a Democrat. I probably identified even farther to the left at any point. But so a lot of times in our circles, Democrats look at the middle of the country and say, you're voting against your self-interest. And if only you knew what I knew, if only you thought what I think, if only, you know, you listened to more NPR or ate more kale, you'd end up voting like me. And that is this really
colonial mentality. That's exactly what settlers think when they first stumbled upon America. Like, these are savages we need to educate. And as leftists, we hate that. Mm. We hate that mentality, and yet we do the same thing. And so that's what, to me, I had to say in the TED Talk, is actually we can get rid of that colonial mentality. We can make a radical stance by saying, I do not understand you. You are still a part of this country. You're part of the fabric of what, of the community that I am in somehow, and that interconnectedness, which is more apparent now. Let me actually understand why you think like you think, what values you hold, why they're important to you, instead of me telling you why mine are the better values. That's mm-hmm. something everybody on every part of the spectrum can learn from. And that was the story I wanted to tell. That's how we do the work at DreamCorps. It's how everything that I've learned from working with Van Jones, it's everything he's about. He does not compromise on values or on his position as someone who's far to the left. But what those values tell us and tell me is that we have to work with people who think differently. Mm. We will not come up with a great solution if we don't. So that's the story I wanted to tell. And I wanted to show people common ground is radical. And I wanted to show people on a large scale, you can do things. It's one thing to say, like, you know, I'm a vegetarian and my neighbors eat meat, but I bet together we can order a pizza and find some common ground.
Right, good example.
I'm sure we can do that. We all have that capability. I wanted to show you can make real change, real impact with it. That's what we do. And we chose three big issues to start with: criminal justice, mm-hmm. tech equity, and green jobs and the green economy. And green jobs and the green economy was our largest initiative, Green for All, that started, you know, 12 years ago. Right. And it was this idea that we knew that a green economy was coming, that there was a whole new set of technology and jobs and that were coming, and they were completely missed communities that are hurting most, communities of color that don't have the job training. And right. Van just started with a very simple action and had kids of color from Oakland putting solar panels on rooftops, and it got a lot of attention. No one had seen that. And that was the idea for me first, to say industry can help solve the problems that our communities are facing. That is not a strategy I was raised with. Ours was like, you just protest, you go into City Hall, you demand your thing, and hopefully it works.
Go raise hell. Yeah. And I let you keep coming back to the word strategy. I think that's important, because you're I love you. Like, yeah, we started with three of the biggest challenges you could think of, right? Speak to your mindset, which I really admire, but it also applies whatever you're trying to tackle, right? Like, this, you're thinking about it strategically. Mm-hmm. Was that talk hard for you? You're obviously not, the speaking part was very easy for you, but was sharing that message something where you're like, oh man, I wonder what these folks are going to say, or you're very active on social media. I can only imagine what that, did you go through any of those, like, ooh, maybe this is a little too much?
Of course.
Yeah. Okay.
Of course. Well, I was giving this talk in Berkeley, where I live. And I knew that this talk could only be good if I challenged the people in that room. And these are the people that probably think most like me. Right. So you can hear, if you listen closely, I don't know if it's on this version that's recently released, but when I say that I work with the Koch brothers to pass criminal justice reform, and we're still working together, and not the Koch brothers, Koch Industries, but the same thing, there's like this audible gasp in the audience. Mm-hmm. And I knew that would be it. I actually toyed with taking it in and out, but I knew it wouldn't be authentic. Yeah. I start off the talk with a picture of me and Speaker Newt Gingrich. Right, and I grew up in Georgia, and everyone knew me in my school. It's funny, I grew up in DeKalb County, which now is a county everybody knows after this week's election. And for us listening to this later, we just came off the Georgia runoffs in the last few days. So now everyone knows DeKalb County. But I remember very distinctly growing up and voting in our school mock election. And there were only two of us in the entire school that voted for Mondale. And I was like, I think I was contrarian in general. I mean, my family, I'm not exactly sure totally. Yeah. I was like in second grade or something.
Yeah. You mentioned your dad's pretty conservative too. So even in the house, it was that way, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so, you know, I remember that. And now to see that district completely blue by like huge margins, that was a huge change in my lifetime. Yeah. But you know what? I completely forgot why I got on this topic.
Well, we were talking about, you know, kind of taking that chance, and that was your platform. Oh, yeah. And were you,
Yeah. So there's a picture of me with Newt Gingrich at the beginning. And I knew that that was
the first couple of minutes, right?
Yeah. I knew that that was the through line. And so everyone I went to school with who knew me as like the one, you know, Democrat or the, you know, they would always count on me in the high school newspaper to write the opposition argument. I was also captain of the debate team. So, you know, super nerd. For all of them, there was like shock. She's standing here in this picture with Newt Gingrich, but that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to say that.
Right.
I think that I can't tell people in different communities how they need to change.
Yeah.
I do think Republicans need to be better. I think Democrats need to be better. We all need to be better. That's just something we need to your podcast. We have to do what we want to do to save the world. We have to do it with joy, and we have to do it like the world is burning, because in California, you know, it literally is burning. So I want to be able to tell my folks, the communities I'm from, whether it's the Indian American community or the punk rock community that I grew up in, or this lefty activist community, like, let's be better. Let's be more strategic. Let's actually see the stuff we've been fighting for our whole lives materialize. Mm. That's what I have to do. That's what the challenge and the scary part of the talk. Yeah. I will leave it to folks on the other side to challenge their side about how to be better. For sure. And I, of course, will tell you what I think. I'm not shy from that. But I knew I had to challenge my folks on the left to think about radical common ground as something powerful.
Yeah. And it's received because you do have the balance in your approach to it. And I want to ask one other thing. Favorite punk rock band? What's
well, I grew up in like this small subset of punk rock, which was the straight edge hardcore punk rock scene in the late 90s.
Very good.
So I don't know.
Good music came out of that. So.
Oh yeah? You know all of this too?
I'm not going to even try and rival your knowledge. I'm a music junkie, but I just thought, you know, that's a good.
So for Bay Area folks out here, I would have to say, of course, I always love Jawbreaker, but I grew up in Georgia. So there are a lot of Georgia bands that, or Southern bands. I can't say there were a lot of Georgia bands that fit that genre you know, I would have done anything for.
We got to do a little research on the local Georgia punk rock. All right. I'm going to look that up there. So I wanted to go back though to, so you were talking about taking that chance, and that's one of your themes. And a lot of what I read about you is taking a bold stance and taking these big challenges. And so you did that in this talk. You also mentioned earlier, I think the way you refer to it is like, my wife and I joke, we're roughly about the same age and married around the same time. And we talk about kind of pre-kids, post-kids. And you refer to it, I think, as like early years and older years or something like that, right? Those were your words, not mine, because you're still very young. So was there a catalyst in there? I know Van played a role in your life as a mentor, but was there a moment, a situation, an event, an arrest? Is there something that moved that for you, that gave you the courage to stand up and call everybody out on both sides, or was it an evolution for you?
It was definitely an evolution, and there was a moment. And I think that's kind of how it works for a lot of folks. My evolution was that I was always this person stuck between two worlds. I was always a bridge builder. I had to bridge my immigrant family with the America we were living in. I had in college a really pivotal experience in one of these arrests. I was actually locked down in the center ring of the three ring circus for animal rights causes. I was in center of Barnum and Bailey Circus, locked by the neck to seven other people. We had practiced, we had rehearsed so we could get down there. And once we locked ourselves, I, you know, kind of looked around from where I could. And I said, I've ruined these children's night. And I was young and I cared about animal rights. I do not think that the animals should be used at the circus. I didn't think it in that moment, but I thought these kids know nothing about why I'm doing this and they're not going to be able to enjoy like maybe their one night out, you know? And it struck me that there has to be a way to do this effectively. And I became a really strong student of nonviolence and nonviolence tactics. And perhaps I was always raised that way as my parents grew up. Coming out of the Indian independence movement, that was very much a part of their recent lives and history. So I had studied, I'd known about Gandhi, and then I studied it even more in college. And I realized that there had been a lot of writing in academia about strategy, about strategic nonviolent action. And you mentioned strategy earlier. And there's an escalation of tactics that have been recommended by Gandhi and then by King, who also studied Gandhi, that you don't start with the most, you don't start with the most escalating tactic. And for Gandhi, that was fasting. He was willing to fast until he died. He would, he said you could sit on a doorstep and fast until the grievance, what you have to be willing to die for. That was the highest escalation in his thing. Yeah. But I was going straight to like locking myself and ruining thousands of people's nights. And so I started that bridge building work too. How could the academic knowledge and the strategic research around nonviolent social change work with what I was experiencing on the streets? And also the academia wasn't learning from what was on the streets because that's been constantly evolving as well. Yeah. And I thought that has to come together. So that evolution, I'm sure, is a big piece of why I'm at where I'm at. But I also think as a young mom, and I mentioned this before, the thing that really changed for me is I thought because of the privilege that I was raised with, and I don't know if this is something that y'all talked about before, but I went to college. My parents definitely went from being immigrants to being in the upper class during my lifetime. And I experienced that middle to upper class in my lifetime. I had a privileged life for the most part. And I thought that I had to use that privilege in a different way in activism. And so I took a job fundraising for the War Resisters League in New York straight out of college. Well, no, I was the organizer there, the national organizer, traveling around the world. Organizing these anti-war demonstrations. And then I said, I need to use my privilege to do something else, which was fundraising. And I'm sure this is true in the sectors that you are in. There are not a lot of people who look like me that sit on boards and ask for the money and do the pitching. And at that point in the early 90s, mid 90s, I don't know, I'm losing track. Somebody told me last night on Clubhouse that anyone born with 19 in front of their year of birth is old enough to drink. Everyone else is not.
Oh my gosh. How's that for a reality check?
I know. It's like, okay, now I can say I was born in the 1900s. And
yeah, exactly. But
whatever year it was, I took a back seat. I took a behind the scenes role. And like I mentioned already, I was captain of the debate team. I was an organizer traveling around the country. I loved being loud and in charge and moving movements. And I thought it was time for me to step back, step behind the scenes and let other people lead, people who were more directly impacted, people who could organize in ways that I couldn't because I didn't understand that experience. I took a back seat. I did that for years. I fundraised for lots of groups that I loved and I found a lot of power in doing that, being someone who looks like me and being able to talk about money. And I was a little bit sad, to say it lightly, and I think a lot of new moms will think about this, in a little bit miserable. And it was different than just that kind of postpartum being alone and isolated that moms in America face. There was something I knew I was missing. And that was the playing the game on a bigger stage. That's how Van Jones' name came onto my list. It's why I took the risk of jumping into a role that I knew would require me to be back in front of the scenes at some point. I took the job and then I stayed behind the scenes. I was Van's chief of staff for quite a long time and I was good at it. I loved it. I loved being the woman to make things happen. I liked feeding that advice, being able to use my smarts and my hearts to make him excel, to make our organization do great things. And it was a hard role. And I can tell you all about those challenges, but I was happy. I was in my comfort zone. And that's when Van said, I think you should be CEO. Once I felt completely comfortable in it, after 6 or 7 years and thought, I could do this forever, he said, it's time for you to be CEO. That was about 2 years ago.
What's the first thing that goes through your head? What's the first thing that comes in your head when you hear that from
No way. I mean, absolutely. I think that I did say no way, actually. I said, no, me? No. Yeah. That's a horrible job. Nobody wants it. You get blamed for everything that goes wrong. You have to give credit to someone else for anything that goes right.
Right.
I've watched you all do it. It's miserable and people are ungrateful and, you know, whatever. I had all of those feelings and I said no. And then I talked to my coworker and she's like, are you crazy? There's nobody else who can run this organization but you. Like, you have to do it. And Van didn't even push me on that call, but I went back to him a day later and I'm like, you know, I talked with Jessica and she said, I should really consider this. And he's like, yeah, I just needed you to say it. Like, wow. Yeah, you need to do this. You have to get out of your comfort zone. You have to do it. Maybe you'll fail, but like you will not grow if you stay where you are right now. And that pushed me to do it. It was very uncomfortable for me to say that. I had a lot of Bambi legs for a long time, but the truth is I've been doing this work my whole life. There's so much I know and then so much I needed to learn that I wouldn't have if I didn't step into it. So it's been 2 years. And the TED Talk was actually one of the first big public speaking things that I had done. I'd of course done panels and those type of stuff, but I hadn't been on stage for a big speech in years and years.
You look like an old pro. Well, good. Well, I appreciate you sharing that. And I can tell like that it means a lot to you that he asked you, but also you're being very honest about how you process that and where you're at. And I want to use this as a chance to step back, because I think one thing that a lot of people can draw inspiration and wisdom from is you think about your roles, right? You're a leader, you're a speaker, you're an activist, you're a writer, you're a mom, you're a wife, these are a lot of different types of roles, and you put yourself in these really uncomfortable spots. Which of these roles is hardest for you right now out of that list there?
Right now, and I think this is different at different points in our lives. I think right now is the public figure part is the hardest for me at the moment. I've reached my comfort zone with being a mom. And after a certain point, the wife is like, we're family. It doesn't feel like wife. It's like, we're this unit, you know, those things are easier now than they were when you have crying babies. And I don't know if you've experienced the same thing, but those feel easy. And you know, CEO, finally, it's been 2 years. The first year was, like I said, those Bambi legs, the beginner's mind, trying things out, and a few big successes can do everything for you, can really build your confidence. But I have to say this to everybody who led in any way during 2020, you have earned all of your stripes, badges, stars, cookies. Like, if you have made it through 2020 as a leader, like, this was not an easy year to do it. None of us were prepared for it. None of us have done it. And so anyone who's gone through this year is like, we're set. I think we'll be able to handle whatever.
I agree with that. And I think there's also a part of it I'm still processing where it took a bigger toll than I think I realized. I think as a leader, you put it all on your shoulders, and it snuck up on me in the fall. And it caught me, and then I kind of grinded through it, which is my DNA. But I still got some work to do to like repair from last year. As much as I like to talk about mindset and being good, it's been a rough go. And leaders aren't there's no exception, right? So I appreciate you saying that. That's a good point.
And we're all gonna have to do it for the first time together. Like, we're all gonna be figuring out how to process last year and move forward more powerfully. No one alive has done what we've done this year. So I do think it's good to find this community of people who want to still perform at a high level and still maintain happiness and joy while doing it. I think these will be the folks that I know you're building this community during this time, that this podcast is new for you, even though your work has been around longer, the happiness and hustle, or what is...
It was all born out of the same, I mean, things I've been talking about, but I got my nudges too. Right. And I had all my imposter syndrome, like, who wants to read my shit, you know, or whatever. And like, I think a lot of us, I believe the innovators win during this time. And so I see it as a window. But my first instinct was to help. How do we go help as many people as we can? And there's so much noise. So to have people like you talk and share, like that's the value for me. I want to, one thing you, there's a phrase you've used, I read somewhere or watched, and it was, it supports what you just shared about becoming CEO, which is, because I didn't know that story. You talk about stepping into courage. And I just wanted to ask you, what does that mean to you now when you talk about stepping into courage? Because a lot of it's in your work, but it's also now kind of a, in your personal, you got to like apply it as a CEO now. And what does it mean to you when you talk about stepping into courage?
I have to go back to, when I was arrested in Burma, honestly. In 1998, I was part of an international group who did an action inside Myanmar, which back then we called Burma a military dictatorship. And we were going to make a point about the democratic movement that had been squashed about 10 years earlier. 8-8-88 was an infamous day in Burmese history when there was a mostly student-led uprising. About 10,000 people were murdered by the military government, more put in exile. 10 years later, I joined an international group to bring attention to this in the military dictatorship. And the one, as I had mentioned, I had already been a student of nonviolence at that point. I had already learned what I wanted to learn from the text. I had been on the streets in some bit of fearlessness, although I had never been feared for my life in the United States protesting. I had certainly thought about fear and courage. And what I knew about the military dictatorship is that they operate on fear. That when they can have fear over you, they can get away with anything. When you're scared, you don't act up. When you don't have that courage, you will be complacent out of fear. And so when I was arrested, I remember the one thing we were all trained to do was don't show fear. That has been their tool. And we also had these American passports that you can kind of get away with being a little bit cocky and fearless when you travel internationally. Now, I look back now and realize that that really wasn't protection. I was the only person arrested that was slapped across the face and handled in a certain way. I look like I could be Burmese. There are a lot of people of Indian descent in Myanmar. And, you know, my life wasn't necessarily going to be granted, but I didn't show fear. And I've taken that lesson with me everywhere. Even when, like, I remember when my son broke his arm, it was gross. It was like a brutal break. I won't talk you through it. But I remember thinking, do not show fear. You have to be courageous. If I show fear, what is he going to feel? This was like, he was in first grade. I think I've always taken that. I'm a person that's good in a crisis. You give me a moment, I know that the worst thing I can do is show fear. And so courage almost came as the learning out of that. Once you know what purpose, and this is for me, once I knew that I had been serving a purpose greater than myself, that there are people who are vulnerable in this country, the people that are hurt first and worst by all the social ills out there, climate change and the criminal justice system and racism and systemic racism. When you know that that's why you're doing the work, the me part goes away. It doesn't become about me and what's going to happen to me. It's just like, I have to have the courage. These are the people that I'm working for. These are the folks I'm talking to. I think I just became courage. Now, it doesn't mean I'm not scared and fearful. And like I said, I'm having a hard time being a public figure and talking about myself for this long is not normal for me. I really do like to talk about the work and the other people and the real human stories of the folks that are on the front lines of a lot of these challenges. And so it is hard. I do have that fear, but I know that nothing's accomplished without that courage. At least in my life,
you found
nothing
the name
good
of your,
happened when I was terrified.
Right, right. Those are the stories you have are so powerful. But I think in there, when you write your autobiography, I found your title. It's going to be called "I Am Courage." That's what you said. I think that's powerful to be able to say that about yourself. Right. I mean, that's there's truth in that. And there's high performers have this weird DNA that we use that to fuel and do so much for others. And then when it's like to take care of ourselves, we're like, oh yeah, that doesn't apply. Like I'll figure it out. I'll grind it through. So let's talk about that. Cause you do intense, difficult work. You thrive in crisis, not a strength of mine, right? Like I have a real mental, struggle with that. I can put on the game face, but it takes a really big toll on me. And so I really admire that. How do you handle, so you've talked about kind of some tools, but what is stress and pressure or burnout? What does that look like for Nisha? Like, when does that hit you? Is there a trigger for you? Is there a moment or a way of noticing when it comes up? But for someone so strong, does that stuff get to you? And if so, what does it look like when it shows up?
So I have one colleague who's my closest colleague. I've worked with her since the start, Summer. She's our COO.
Okay.
And I can compare myself to her in that I know when she's about to hit that. There, and she'll tell you there's a few obvious signs that tend to do with overwhelm. And I'm not saying anything she's going to get upset with me about.
Fair enough.
You see this thing of, it's not even gradual. There's a moment, it's like overwhelm. I'm like, oh, Summer's going to have the moment. And she goes there. Mm-hmm. Mine isn't quite the same. I hit it. I know what it looks like after it's done, but I don't know the trigger. When I hit it, I just want to be in my pajamas, in bed, watching TV, and I do not want to talk to anyone in my family. And I'm an extrovert. I usually want to know everything about everyone's life. You can tell me what sandwich you ate today, and it will fascinate me. So it is a very, I've hit it when I get in that mood.
Okay.
I'm sure if you ask my husband, he has more observations.
He's a different list, yeah.
You should ask Summer, actually. And
right. There we go. There we go.
So I certainly hit it. But I think I am someone who thrives in crisis. I am pretty level. I do say, when I start hearing myself say, it's okay, everything's fine, everything's going to be fine, I think that's when I know things are not okay and not fine.
Mm, okay.
That's my coping mechanism. I certainly learned it when I was little, that a lot of children of divorce cope in all sorts of ways. But I think mine was to just be a fix-it person. I can fix it. I can solve it. Everything's okay. I'm just going to do it. And so if I recognize that, I know something's not okay and I need to pay attention
okay.
to it.
I get it. That's where my drive came from, as divorced at a young age. And I'm going to show everybody I can do it. And we all have our mechanisms, right? That was my way of trying to get attention, was to just like be the top performer in everything that I did. So what about the reverse? So you're in PJs. Had a shitty day or week or whatever. It's been a week, by the way. So we're all allowed to go have a drink after this, but there's work to be done, right? And and so for you, I mean, this is real talk. Like this is when you got to arrive. You got to show up at the fire. How do you get out of that mode? So when you're there and you've got to rally the troops, or you've got to you've got to have the game face, other than just telling yourself that, how do you actually show up in such a powerful, authentic way when you're in such a stressful, high pressure, intense, with a high stakes environment? Yeah. Right,
there are definitely days this year that I didn't want to show up as the leader, and I sometimes just have to like be like, you're the boss. These people are counting on you. You know, there is that self-talk you have to do. And knowing that nobody knew what to do last year meant that every option was available to me. I could literally do anything and it was going to be more helpful than doing nothing. I also, and I can't stress this enough, and I'm sure other people have stressed this too, how important great friends and mentors are. Like, I get to call the highest performer I've ever met in my life, Van Jones, and be like, this is the problem I'm having. What do I do? And it's usually some version of, stop whining. You're worried about the wrong things. And he'll tell me what I'm worried about that I shouldn't be. Or right. He'll tell me what's getting me down that I don't even realize is getting me down. And we'll push right through it. And he's a great communicator. So I got to say, yes. I'm lucky to have someone who can sometimes tell me what to say.
Good mentor to call you out. How do you, one question I get a lot, because I've been blessed to have been supported, loved, coached by some of the best humans ever. Mm-hmm. And how have you found those people for you in your life? You're obviously not afraid to ask. Was it just simple of asking, or have you been more intentional about it, or has it just been serendipity, or what's happened?
I was lucky growing up. Part of, I think, my family's values and coming from India and being immigrants is the Indian culture is very much like everyone's your family. We call people auntie and uncle who have no blood relation to us, because everyone has that job of being your auntie and uncle in our culture. And so I was lucky that, you know, we were in Atlanta, Georgia in the 80s. There were not many Indians there. It was a very black and white town. So basically anyone who immigrated from India while we lived there lived in our house. That's just how it was. That's what you did. This person might not be, you know, anywhere related to us, but they lived with us and my life was better because of it. There were people in and out of my life of all different things as a young kid, who I learned a lot from. That is a huge, huge blessing. And I think that must be a big piece of what made me seek out that mentorship, because learning can happen anywhere. I had great teachers in college. I had great people who lived with us growing up, who I still go to for advice for certain things. People I have absolutely nothing in common with, but like, you know, I watched this person show love to her daughters more than anyone I've ever seen in my life. And so I will always go to her for help around that, you know. I think that's where it comes from, is that deep knowing that you don't know everything.
Yeah.
The deep knowing that other people know things that you don't, that you need to learn from. And just that, like, that desire to learn and grow and
get and be better. I like that. You're intentional about you're sincerely interested. I think you mentioned that earlier, like you want to know what sandwich I ate. And but I think that served you in a way where you're very interested in, and now you see where they can benefit you and add value and teach you, because you have that mindset. I think that's really powerful. I think early in my career, I blew right through that. I missed so many opportunities to learn because I wanted to prove I was better. I could love more than hurt. You know, like everything was a freaking competition.
Oh yeah.
And then you figure out, oh yeah, there's a lot of
and
wisdom.
Let's be real. I am competitive, and I think a lot of us have to be.
Yeah.
But the competition is what knowing how other people think gives you a competitive advantage. Learning from other people gives you a competitive advantage. That is how we win. I mean, that also is part of the strategy. So yeah, there's a human quality to it. I'm generally curious. People are fascinating. We are like some of the strangest creature. I mean, I'm sure we are the strangest creature out there. Like endlessly fascinating. That's true. But also, I mean, how else are we going to accomplish things if we don't harness all of that information out there? We value stuff that's written in books. So highly, but like just asking someone, wait, why do you think that?
Right.
That is a type of knowledge that's not so readily available, that I think really helps us.
I love it. I want to, as we turn the corner and start to wrap up, I want to get to something that struck me the most in your video, where you talked about choosing love.
Mm.
And that's an important word to me. And, I appreciated your approach, and I want to read something that came from your values at DreamCorp and then I kind of apply this. And it says, and I don't know who wrote, if you wrote, this is beautifully written. It said, "We cultivate presence, conviction, and love. How we do what we do matters. Authenticity, depth, and passion matter. We celebrate culture and creativity. We honor the immeasurable. We operate from a place of fierce and unconditional love that is rooted in relationship and connection. We believe in magic. We are awake and alive in this work." That gave me goosebumps. That is good stuff. This is how I feel like is your secret power of doing such difficult work and being happy and like rooted in love, which doesn't exist in this world. Like, they don't talk about love on CNN a whole lot.
No.
How in the hell do you do it? Like, where does this whole root in love, and how have you found happiness in such a intense world? Like, it's fascinating to me.
Well, I love hearing you read that out loud. And, you know, a lot of companies go through, how are we going to define our values and what are our values going to be?
Yeah.
And I was the person, I wasn't CEO then, but I was the person so annoyed at how long the process was taking, just so you know. I'm like, it has been a year that we've been developing these. Why are we talking about them? Every staff meeting, we're taking like people's, you know, opinions on them. We're doing all sorts of exercises. I'm like, I've answered these 10 questions about our core values.
Let's get on with it.
Yeah. And we came up with three that have been so powerful for us: the servant leadership, solutions, and soul. And I think you're reading from soul. Which is a word that is an atheist who's not very connected on the spiritual side. Van will tell you that I'm one of his secular people. There are not many in his world, but there are a few of us out there. And so the word soul and the word magic were hard for me to wrap my head around, certainly. But it is something that even secular folks like me can get behind. When you do this work with soul, and when you believe in the magic that happens when people connect on those deep levels,
you get results that are unimaginable. And that was absent. Like, there is a love of our people that is definitely evident on all parts of the left. But you can't just live in a world where you only love people just like you. That doesn't work. My core value around love and my belief that revolutionary love is a force for good in this world certainly comes from, and I've mentioned it a lot, which I don't usually mention a lot, but in this conversation we have around the study of nonviolence, around the idea that you have to love the people who you are working to try to change. If you actually want to change hearts and minds, you have to believe in the power of that love. And so I don't think it's like Valentine's card love. I don't think it's the cheap kind of love we're used to talking about. I think it's the hard love where you have to love even when it hurts, when you have to love people who do not love you back, who actually would rather you not be in the room, not be at the table, not be in the country. That love is hard, but it's the type of love that allows the connection to change. If you've asked anybody, anyone in the history of the world who was a KKK member and is now an ex-KKK member, who was definitely racist and then became, you know, less racist or not racist, you will find this also with anyone, and this wasn't long ago for a lot of us, where gay marriage wasn't something that the majority of the country could even think was possible or wanted, have now completely shifted to where it is the norm. People will tell you it's because somebody offered love that came from a different perspective. Someone offered acceptance that came from a different perspective. Somebody was able to kind of penetrate that. Yeah. And it is a horrible thing to say, or to prescribe to everybody. But I think it is the thing we all have to do. And that's a little unclear, but what I want to say is often we have this critique where, you know, me as a woman of color, it's not my job to educate white guys about race. It's not my job to educate men about sexism. We say that a lot. Yeah. And I used to say it a lot. I actually gave trainings around the country, back in the early 2000s around anti-racism. I traveled the country in a bus training people. And I would say this exact thing. It's not my job to go around and teach everybody, you know, white people have to teach white people. I'm not sure what that means anymore. I believe it's important. I think that every single person has a job in talking about racism and understanding it. I do think that there is a safe learning environment that can happen when you're talking to people from your own community because you're struggling with the same things. I think there is some deep learning that can come from that. But I don't think that means I won't talk to somebody who believes differently than me or who might have a different view on systemic racism. I have to explain why I see it differently. And usually that's what I say. I say, huh, I see it differently. I think I get curious about why someone might say, no, there's no, you know, racism in our criminal justice system. That's not why it's broken. Really? Why do you think that? So first get curious. And then I just say, well, I see it differently. I think you have to be curious, why do they see it that way? And then I get to explain why I see it differently. That moves people more than anything else. People don't move when they're shamed. If someone says, I don't see racism in the criminal justice system, yeah, intellectually, I think that is not, you know, a very smart position to hold. The evidence doesn't show it or whatever. Right. But if I just shame and say, that's stupid, have you read anything before? That person will never change.
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, it's not strategic.
It's not strategic. And so strategic. I'm hearing
love is love both
transcends all of this for you.
It does.
Yeah.
I also wasn't built to hate. I'm never going to out-hate the haters. Like I said, I'm a softie. Let them do hate. They do it well. But if I try to out-hate them with my strategy, I'm going to lose. I just can't do it. The tool I do have is love. So I think there is a moral love. I think that is absolutely what nonviolence is at its core. I think that's what it means to be in a community together. You have to love everybody in the community. You have to. It does not work to say, I'm only going to lead the people just like me. I'm only going to govern people in the country who are just like me. I mean, we just had a president who did that, and that turned out terribly. You have to say, even if you didn't vote for me, I'm going to make this country work for you because I love this country and everybody in it. There is a moral, personal part about love, but there is also a strategic piece. It makes me a better person. I don't have to carry around the hate, And it's also the thing that's going to help change hearts and minds, offering that love that people have offered me while I've grown and while I've been able to see different perspectives. I owe that gift to everyone who's given it to me. I owe it to other people.
Well, it's authentic, and it's no matter what you read about you or watch, or you look at the causes you've been involved with, it's consistent with your message. And I appreciate sharing that. And again, how you're tying strategy. I hope that what everybody heard, aside from just being inspired by your story and what you've accomplished and the bold curiosity and courage that you display, that they also learn there's a different way to do this stuff. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we're just keep trying to get better at the same thing. And you come at strategy from a whole different place. You come at love from a whole different place. And it's just so refreshing.
I have to say that anyone who's interested in love as a revolutionary force and as a strategy, I would be remiss not to tell you about our partner and just a wonderful human being that we work with named Valerie Kaur, who wrote a recent book called See No Stranger.
Okay.
And it is about it's about love as a revolutionary force. If you go to our website, you can certainly type in, revolutionary love or See No Stranger, and you'll find her book, but you'll also find her TED Talk, which is much more popular than mine. And is, if you want to see soul and love emanating out of a person in every core of their being, like, she's the person. So a lot of this, she's a leader on, and I take from her absolutely. So I can't recommend that enough.
Thank you. I'll make sure and link to her book and her talk in our notes here. As we wrap up, we've talked about strategy and being in difficult situations and problem solving and how we woven your life story through all of this. When you put it all together, which you don't give yourself much credit for, but when you put it all together and you're a high performer and you've found this just happiness in such an unlikely place of where you've inserted yourself into the world and the challenges you take on, what is it like for you? What does it feel when it's all lined up for you? When those two things are coming together, I remember in your talk, you lit up, your energy changed on stage when you talked about the videos you get at work every day. When your high performance happiness is together, what does it mean to you, or how does it feel?
Yeah, absolutely. I got like this moment of feeling like crying when you mentioned the videos. You talked about this one piece of legislation that's brought home, I think, about 14,000 people now, the First Step Act. And because we fought so hard for it, and we were one of the most visible groups on passing that legislation, folks who came home, we got the videos of the first time they had seen their families coming home from prison on these sentences that never should have been that long, on things that never should have been charged or even gone to jail for. And we would get videos of the first time they're seeing their family in decades. And every time we get one of those, we share it on our Slack. My staff will share the good notes and those hugs. And even if it's not even related to us, that keeps me grounded in why I do what I do. That is the reason. Like, it isn't about me. It's about those moments of power and love and joy. And that's what keeps us, like, I could cite numbers of all the things we need to change and, these great things we've done, but it really is that human story that keeps us moving. And I love seeing people moving towards storytelling as a way to talk about their work, business and nonprofit sector. Yeah. Because I do think that's what sticks with us. That's what moves us. And you cannot change legislation without doing that humanization first. Like, when I started, the main thought was that folks behind bars weren't humans, weren't people. Like, I remember a Facebook battle I got back into way in the day when I was like, oh, a hurricane's about to hit New York and they're not going to, evacuate Rikers. It's going to flood. And people wrote back, why would we do that? Like, why would we even worry about them instead of, the other people? That mentality was pervasive. And I feel like that's gone for the most part. In just a decade, the work we did on telling the stories of the humans that are actually there, that humanization work, has changed the entire, like, it's culture change. Like that's changing the narrative where folks are like, yeah, maybe people shouldn't be paid $1 a week, you know, in prison. Maybe we should give them some type of training and education. So when they come home, which most people do, like 90% of the people inside will come home one day. How about we try to make it so they come home better than they were when they went in?
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, now folks see that and they didn't then. It was like, I guess they did something wrong. Lock them up and it's over. So those stories certainly give me joy.
Stories. Well, you've got an amazing story and I appreciate you sharing it here. And I don't think you probably recognize yet. I look forward to staying connected with you and hopefully getting to talk again someday, because I think your story's certainly still being written. And I don't think you quite understand yet the impact you're making. Yeah. And I hope that will digest and hit you at some point. But it made a difference for me. It made a difference for our team. And it's going to make a difference for the little community that I have and serve. So thank you. Thank you for inspiring us with your story and being humble enough to share it with us. And it's just going to be so fun to watch you continue to write it. So appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you for those kind words. You've definitely sent me off to a great night after such a really hard week.
It was a hard when I can make it to the bear, when humans can get together, we'll make it down and we'll share a beverage. But until then, how can we find you? What's the best place to check you out and follow you and support you?
Definitely. On Twitter and Instagram, you can find me Nisha M, as in Marie, which is my middle name, Nisha M Anand, A-N-A-N-D. That's Twitter and Instagram. But also our website, thedreamcorps.us, is our website. Corps spelled like Marine Corps and Peace Corps. We're the Dream Corps. We believe in the possibility and the beauty of the American dream, and we're really fighting to get us towards that more perfect union. So all of anything about me is linked there for the most part. And
very good.
Yeah.
Well, I will make sure we'll link to all of that in the show notes. And for everybody listening, we'll have more detail on the interview up on healthandhustle.com at the blog. And highly recommend check out her TED Talk amongst some of her personal blogs. She didn't even mention that, but she's has a very thoughtful blog I'd encourage you to check out. So thank you, Nisha. It was awesome.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right.
Good night.